Okay, let me just get it up here. Yes, it was a great trip. I think some of you who are with us in Morocco are here. Rabbi Kelvin was able to join us. Let me just I like to have a second computer here to see things. Actually, something happened. I can share it with people that I thought of something here. Yaakov Emden. It's not relevant to Zacharia Frankel. I think we'll have two more classes today and one more because we are coming to the end. But Rabbi Kelman, you probably remember this story, but I'll throw in something interesting. Okay, so we have Minyan, so we have Kriyas HaTorah. So I basically prepare the Kriyas HaTorah, except not 100% because I'm assuming there's going to be people there who can lane, but I looked it over. So there was, we had two Balei Kriya, but Shabbos afternoon, none of them were there in the shul yet when it was time to lane. So I got up to lane and I announced that don't know how well I did it, know it, so please correct me. First two Aliyahs were fine. The last Aliyah, the third Aliyah, I made a mistake and two people or three people called out, including a woman. That was interesting. A woman called out and corrected the mistake. So, we corrected it and finished the Torah reading. What's interesting is that after I finished the laning, I remembered that this was the mistake I made was an important, well, I don't know, important. It was a mentioned, it was a point in Rav Yaakov Emden's autobiography. So since I know there's people here who are interested in Rav Yaakov Emden, I'm going to show you right now what the error was and what Rav Yaakov Emden's point was here and why it's a little significant. Let me, for those who are interested in Yaakov Emden, J.J. Schachter's book, long-awaited edition, I should say, of Rav Yaakov Emden's autobiography, supposedly is coming out soon. Okay, so it was Parshas Shmos, and it's in, here you go, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Tes Zayin. So, it's Vayomer b'Alchanas Ivrios. Now here's the words: Risen al ha'ovnayin. But without nekudos, it's likely that you could read avanim. That is, when you avnayim is translated birth stool, avanim would be the stones. Okay, so of course I didn't read it avnayim, and I was corrected. End of story. You would think this yud mem ending, like aznayim, this is when you have it pairs too. However, and I only remembered this after I was corrected. Rav Yaakov Emden has a whole piece. You find it. You'll find it in J.J. Schachter's edition, no doubt, because he's not going to censor anything. In the new edition in the U.S. Sefer, they took this section out, but it's in the first couple of editions. For example, the Kahan edition, page 135, he's attacking before Rav Yonasan Eibshitz comes into the picture, Rav Yecheskel Katzenelnbogen, Rav of Altona. So he's attacking him for all sorts of ways. And on page 135, he tells the story how when the Chazan was reading the Torah and he got to this pasuk, and lo and behold, the Chazan read it correctly, Avnayim. And Rabbi Chesel Katzenelnbogen rebuked him and said he's making a mistake. It should be Avanim. And in other words, so we see that the great Rabbi Chesel Katzenelnbogen got it wrong. I'm not sure how he got it wrong. He could have looked in the Torah, but he was obviously doing it orally, or he wasn't looking in and he saw it. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden uses this to make fun of him, and that he says Kachaya baki b'kriya b'dvarim shebichsav. And then he goes and shows his ignorance in Talmud and just tears him apart. But that's Rav Yaakov Emden with his enemies. So, okay, I'll go a few more minutes. A number of you sent me things, so let me get as far as I can get. I also want to get back to the issue with Mao Sor and the part I was a bit flustered with at the end of the class I listened about the word safnat before we begin. But I want to show you something else because we've spoken about Eisenstein, Judah David Eisenstein. And this relates to the questions we had where Frankel was asked about figures. You know, we saw about making a sculpture, a statue of someone. So here's something relevant to that, and it shows you really a pretty crazy mistake. So in the Jewish Encyclopedia, which is still a very good work, even though it's like 120 years old, some of the essays in it are quite good, and they include things not in the Jewish Encyclopedia Judaica. So in the essay dealing with matzah, one of the classes I'm going to be giving on the Pesach program this year deals with machine matzah. So I'm interested in matzah. I've been looking into it. So here you have an article by, it says Joseph Jacobs, Judah David Eisenstein. The part that I'm referring to over here is certainly by Eisenstein. And he talks about how in the past you had matzah with different figures. That is, they'd make matzah, not just the way we make it, but in different types of figures. And here it says in the middle, Rav Isaac ben Gayat, that's the Ritz-Gayat, says the figures represented Greeks, doves, and fishes. So they made matzah looking like Greeks, people, doves, and fishes. Okay, by the way, the word fish, there's also a plural, even though we're taught as kids that there's no plural for fish. There is a plural. Okay, so what does this come from? Well, oops, sorry. I can't find what I want to show you in the but let me read you what Ritz-Gayat says here. And I think you'll find it interesting. Actually, I can pull it up and you can see it on the screen here. Let me stop sharing this, and I think I can share another screen. Yeah, it's amazing. So it says at the bottom here, they ask, "What's my srikin hamitzuyarin?" That is, the Talmud speaks about these Syrian cakes, or however you translate that. And then so what are they? It says pas, bread, meaning matzah, ha'asuya, suros, demus. Now, he translates this yevonim. It's not yevonim. It's yonim, the dagim, the shart suros. That's the this matzah they made, this unleavened bread, Syrian cakes, not matzah that you'd use at the Seder or anything. They made it in images. They made it of doves, of fish, and other tsurot. Where Eisenstein got Greeks, and if you're going to say Greeks, then where are the doves? It's either Greeks or doves. Now, Goodenow, Professor Goodenow, who wrote so many important works, the Second Temple times, he actually cites this also from Eisenstein. That in talking about Jewish Greek relationships, that they would make, cakes in the images of Greeks, but it's not Greeks. It's doves. I'm not sure how Eisenstein made that mistake, but there you have it.
It was the perforations that had the shape, not the matzah.
Yeah, no, I mean the perforations. Yes, but it's not Greeks. I don't even know what that would mean, but it's the Yonah. Yes, you're correct. Okay, this goes to David Glasner. I don't know if David is with us now, but we're talking at the end about these words, the word asnat and osnat, and if the samech, and I guess it would be the same with the pei, safnat, if it's a shvanah or shvanach. And at first I said shvanach, but it's obviously shvanah, and I said I was flustered. I'll tell you why I was flustered. Incidentally, one of you sent me, Ian sent me, that the Vilna Gaon actually agrees with the modern Israeli pronunciation. He thinks that it's osnat. But let's leave that aside for a minute. The reason I was flustered is because I was trying to give an example where following a kamatz gadol, a tnuah gedola, that you have a shvanah. And I had forgotten the rule, but now I looked it up. I have the rule, so I'll show you for those few of you who are interested in these sorts of things. Let's see. I have put it up here for a second. Do I have it here? Okay, I don't know if I can find it here. But so, for example, you have the word kedma, or Katomti Mikola Hasidim in Breishis. The rule is if the trup is on the, let's say it's Mila'el, if the trup is on the syllable that precedes the Shva, then it's a Shva Nach. So it's Katonti, not Katonati. And the same thing with Kedema. So that's what I was trying to summon, but I had forgotten it. Incidentally, this rule that we were speaking about is not accepted by everyone anyway. So for instance, we say in Shema, B'chol Levavacha. I think if you look in Art Scroll, it'll note that B'chol Levavacha, because it's after Kamatz there, Levavacha, the vet, the second vet is Shva Na, and yet Rav Yosef Karo, I think the Raiva, they did not accept this. So, but we follow the Radak's understanding. Okay, one more thing I want to point out for you, and this takes us back to Mao Sor. We get to that. You know what? I'm going to hold off on the Mao Sor. I got the about the Tikkun based Tefillah Tei. I think next class I'll have time to get to that. I just want to get to Frankel today, though. Make sure I finish what I want to finish. And we spoke about why Tikkun beis Tefillah Tei is it's Tikkun, it's not Yikkun, and that it's passive. I saw one interpretation. The reason it's passive is because, you know, there's this dispute in the Talmud. Is the future Talmud going to be built miraculously? That is God going to build it? It's going to descend from heaven. Rashi mentions that. Or like the Rambam's opinion that we're going to build it. So therefore, it's passive. That the future temple will be built. It leaves it ambiguous whether it's going to be human built or whether it's going to be built by Kadosh Baruch Hu. But we still have the question, which we got to raise, got the answer, which we'll get to next. Either the end of today, if I get to it, or next class, why is it, if bait is masculine, as it is masculine, then why is it T-code? It should be E-code. Now, you might want to say, what do I mean when I say it's masculine? Maybe it's feminine. It has been understood as feminine sometimes. So, for example, here is... just to give you one example, I had seen this, so I took note of this. This is a poem, and you have a lot of these at the JTS, these Italian poems for someone when he becomes married or graduates the school in Padua. So what does it say? Mizmor Shir Chanukat Beit HaKnesset HaGdola. So in Ferrara. So they made, here's a song. And obviously the people who write these songs are experts in Hebrew. We couldn't. I shouldn't say we, I and most of us could not write this sort of poetry. So here you have an example of a song that was written in honor of the great synagogue in Ferrara. And you can read the poem, but look, it doesn't say Beit HaKnesset HaGadol, it's Beit HaKnesset HaGadolah. So we see that some people understood Bayit as feminine, even though that's it's almost universally, it's doesn't appear this way in Tanakh. But I guess the thinking was that the word developed. It's hard to imagine that someone who's capable of doing such rhyme here is makes a simple grammatical error. I think it's just that it became accepted in certain places. Okay, well, we'll leave that aside for now. And let's pick up right where we left off, but it's been a few weeks. Okay, if you recall, the last thing we spoke about was the issue of Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. I just want to make one more point, and that has to do with the hermeneutical principles. Because it wasn't just that Frankel was accused of denying Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai as... being literal, and we saw last time we met that he takes this back, he retracts it, or he clarifies this understanding in the additions to the book. But what about, he was also attacked for, and they specifically mentioned Gezeirah Shavah, that if you read Darchei HaMishnah, the implication is that the Gezeirah Shavah is just the sages using their brilliance, their intuitive understanding of language, that they had a special ability that that the average person doesn't have in order to make connections. And usually we're taught that Gezeirah Shavah comes from Sinai. And so that would be enough to place him in the category of heretic, or at least what he's saying is heresy. But is that true? I think that is the mainstream view, but is that the only view? Do we find anywhere in the Rambam, for instance, that Gezeirah Shavah goes back to Sinai? He assumes that the hermeneutical principles have the status of a derabbanan. That doesn't mean that they are all derabbanan. This could be a technical thing, that if they're not explicit and they're derived hermeneutically, that they're understood to be derabbanan. At least that's how most understand the Rambam. But I want to tell you something here, read you something, and you tell me if Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch would have had the same response to what I'm going to read now. I already read last class the Riyam Shal Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Oria. We're not dealing with a small person here. In the Yom Shal Shlomo Baba Kama Perachet Simon Aleph, where he mentions explicitly Kama Gezeira Shavos of Kama Kare Darish Talmuda Al Zev Umatzrichin Akabla Ish Mi Pi Ish. So he says that why do we need to assume that all Gezeira Shavos are Ish Mi Pi Ish going back to Sinai? However, there was a figure named Rav Gedalia Nadel. Rav Gedalia Nadel was a Talmud Muvhak of the Chazon Ish. And he came to public notice for many people because during the controversy over Rabbi Nassim Slifkin's books that the Haredi world banned them, someone pointed out that Rav Gedalia Nadel held also that evolution is not in opposition to Torah, just you have to understand it properly. And these are all found in his book, The Torah Social Rav Gedalia. And that's why the book became popular, mostly because of how he understands the idea of evolution and, the old way of explaining the first chapters of Reishis, that we don't have to take them literally. Okay, no news there. However, most people did not read on. And if you get to page 25, you have something very interesting. He speaks about the idea that you don't make a Gezeirah Shavah on your own. That's what the Gemara says, that we don't make a Gezeirah Shavah on our own. And what's the reason? Well, Rashi says, because, he explains that it goes back to Sinai. Therefore, you only accept it. Well, the Gemara says, Rashi explains, you don't make a Gezeirah Shavah on your own. It has to be something that you've received, Rav mi Rav, going all the way back to Sinai. However, Rav Gedalia Nadel doesn't accept this, or at least he assumes that this is not the standard interpretation, what Rashi's interpretation is. I'm just going to read you, let me read you what Rav Shelat, who published the B'Torah Social Rav Gedalia, he says as follows. You'll find this in Aliyot 27 and 28, that's from Shivas Birkas Moshe, Malia Duming. This is before it was published. He's saying what he heard from Gedalia Nadel. Then we'll see what it says in the Sefer. When the Torah says, Ein Adam Dan Gezeirah Shavah Me'atzmo, it doesn't mean that Gezeirah Shavahs are from Sinai. Because all it says is, Ein Adam Dan Gezeirah Shavah Me'atzmo. It doesn't say in the Gemara, unless you received it from a tradition going back to Sinai. That's what Rashi says. This is what Gedalia Nadel says. A Gezeirah Shavah is like other midos that the Torah is derived from. Ki derech limud shachachamim amurim lishtamesh ba kadei legos as dine ha-Torah shalo nechtebe ferush. That it's just a way of, it's like all the other hermeneutical principles that the sages have this ability to use them to understand Torah. And the difference is that Gezeirah Shavah is different than the other midos because it's mida adina ma'od. You have to be much more careful with Gezeirah Shavah because anyone can come and abuse it by taking all, just because you see similar words, you can come up with anything. King lo kol shtei milim zaos re'uyos hashvos al piyem dinim. Because not every every words that are the same, you can come and make laws. Rak chachamim gedolim hayordim laomek hadvarim reshayim ledrosh gezeirah shavah. So Rav Gedalia Nadel says that no, the gezeirah shavah is creative exegesis of the sages, but only the sages through their greatness can do that, and that's what it means that you can't don a gezeirah shavah on yourself. In other words, that you have to have received it from your teachers. And what's the Kavanah? You have to have a Masorah of Chachamim who thought that this was the way to darshan it, but not that it goes back to Sinai. And he explains it himself. You can see it. Well, I mean, the summary of his Shiurim from Rabbi Shalat on page 25. And he says, you need to have Masorahs of Doros, Rabim, Shakuam, Lamdukach. That this is what you, so, but he denies, and this is not a conservative or historical school book, he denies that it goes back to Sinai. He says, Lav Dafka Mimoshe Misinai. And so that's basically what Franco was saying. He was saying that, I mean, Franco is saying exactly what Gedalia Nadel is saying, or Gedalia Nadel is saying exactly what Franco is saying. So I think in this matter as well, and it needs investigation, what the Rishonim say, how they interpret it, and it could be Gedalia Nadel is wrong. But again, we're talking about someone who's really part of Haredi learned society, and he came up with this on his own. So it's not so strange. It's not so far-fetched. And I don't think that alone would be enough to make him, as we'd say, Michutz L'machana. But there's more. And in these areas, I have to acknowledge, for all my admiration for Franco's scholarship and what I've learned from him, it's problematic. Because it's not just Franco's own works that are subject to attack. Frankel's institution, he had teaching near Gretz. Gretz, by no stretch of the imagination, can be regarded as an authentic exponent of the tradition. And that's going to bring us back to the issue we had with the Jewish Theological Seminary. How do you have an institution that allows someone like Mordechai Kaplan teaching there? I'm talking about in an era when you had many people teaching there who would be considered completely in the Orthodox camp, but how can the institution be regarded in the Orthodox camp when you have someone like Mordechai Kaplan? And you could say, as I said, that, well, they gave Kaplan, you know, he taught homiletics. That's his thing. But my son-in-law's grandfather, Rabbi Sylvan Kamens, rabbi for many years, conservative rabbi for many years in Minnesota, as well as other places. I even think that he was Bob Dylan's family rabbi where was he? In Hibbings or Duluth, one of those places. So I asked him about this at the Bris, actually, the Bris of my grandson a couple months ago. And he's from the old time rabbis. He remembers Kaplan. And he said to me, Bazel, Ashon, yes, they put him in to teach Midrash or homiletics. But this is what he said, whatever Kaplan was assigned to teach, no matter what, he was always teaching Kaplan. So he'd be teaching homiletics, but he's teaching Kaplan's ideology. He's teaching Midrash, but it's all Kaplan. You really don't, you don't achieve it. You don't solve the problem there. Now, with the seminary in Breslau, one thing was off the limits, even for Gretz, by the way, and that is Pentateuchal criticism. There was no higher criticism of the Torah. There was higher criticism, however, of the rest of Vanach. That in and of itself might also not be enough to render it outside the fold, because they did at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, they did higher criticism. Yaakov Barth, who's the son-in-law of Israel Hildesheimer, he taught the second Isaiah, and he taught that that's why it was regarded by the Hirschians as a problematic institution. But it goes much further than that, because Gretz's whole conception of if Frankel, it was questionable what he thought, and he left ambiguity and then clarified it. With Gretz, there's no ambiguity. There is nothing Misinai. Everything's from the rabbis. There's a complete development of ideas in Nach. I mean, nothing in the traditional. And I don't know if it's true, but the fact that they tell the story shows what he was like. Supposedly, Gretz would read the Haftorah when he was called up to read the Haftorah with his own emendations. So you'd read that, which is totally in opposition to the idea of the historical school. Now, if you recall, Hirsch publishes an open letter when they opened the seminary in Breslau. He publishes an open letter asking Frankel what his new seminary's position was on revelation, on tradition and custom, but Frankel never replied. And here you have Gretz teaching there. Regarding Gretz, I found something interesting in Bernard Drachman's autobiography. Bernard Drachman, one of the founders of American Orthodoxy, one of the early leaders of American Orthodoxy, he is a musmach of Breslau. As we mentioned, you have a number of Breslau-produced people who were middle of the road, who became reformers, and also who were observant, Orthodox even. And let me just read you what he says. And it just shows you that here is someone who is obviously an intelligent person who studied in Breslau, not when Franco was there, but when Gretz was there, and when Franco's successor, Levy, is there. And he says as follows, and I'll read you what he says about Gretz. He doesn't think that Gretz is going to apostle the institution any more than Yeshiva University would be apostled, because maybe someone in the Bernard Revel Graduate School might say something that is regarded as crossing the line. Solomon Seitlin, who later was at Dropsy College, but his first job was at the graduate school. It wasn't Bernard Revel, but he was teaching at Yeshiva College, and the Rosh Yeshiva were very upset with him and launched a protest because of an article he published. But he was teaching there, and I don't think anyone was going to say that it wasn't Yeshiva University then, it was Yeshiva College, is Michutz L'Machane because of this. But on page 100, this is what Drachman says. He quotes, he mentions the view that the Hildesheimer Seminary is the most strictly Orthodox, the Geiger Seminary is radical and heterodox, and the Breslau Seminary occupies an intermediate position which might be designated as moderate or liberal Orthodox. And then he says, but I must say that I do not entirely agree with this view. The Breslau Seminary insisted upon the bindingness of Jewish law, which is, after all, the criterion of orthodoxy or heterodoxy in Judaism, while the Berlin Rabbiner Seminar advocated the harmonious union of Orthodox faith and modern culture, which is rejected by some Orthodox elements. The Breslau and Berlin seminaries were therefore in fundamental harmony on the basic concepts of traditional Judaism and its adjustment to modern conditions. Well, he says, and he's correct, that the Breslau Seminary insisted on the bindingness of Jewish law, and then he says that this is the criterion of orthodoxy or heterodoxy in Judaism. But it's not really the case, because everyone acknowledged that Breslau, even Hirsch acknowledged that in Breslau, they insisted on Jewish law. That wasn't the dispute. And we're not dealing with orthoprax here. The issue is orthodox, orthodox, straight thinking. That was what the dispute was about. Namely, was Frankl and his institution teaching an orthopraxy rather than an orthodoxy, that is a denial of certain ikarei emunah, basic ideas of faith. And I can't figure out how Drachman could say that the bindingness, I don't know if he made that word up, but the bindingness of Jewish law is the criterion of orthodoxy or heterodoxy, because at least according to Hirsch, it absolutely is not. It's do you believe that this law that you're obeying, which is called Halacha Moshe Sinai, is this something made up by the rabbis, or is this something that goes back to Sinai? If observance of Jewish law is all that matters, well, then you could say that the whole Torah is invented by people, and because you're following it, you believe, you can come up with all sorts of reasons to follow the laws in the Torah. So if I say that I believe in following the laws of the Torah because they're the folkways, or they're the national constitution, but they were invented by wise men living 3,000 years ago, Drachman wouldn't say that that's orthodox. So I have a hard time with what he's saying. Then he, on page 104, that's when he starts speaking about Gretz. And he says that that Gretz was... taught Jewish history and gave courses in biblical exegesis and Talmud, great Jewish historians. But listen to this. His biblical interpretations and in particularly his emendations of biblical texts often aroused considerable opposition. His attitude towards biblical criticism seemed to be in contradiction to his general religious view. He was a sturdy champion of traditional Judaism, and an uncompromising opponent of Reform innovations in the ritual practices of the Jewish faith, but certainly no upholder of the authenticity of the Masoretic texts of the Bible. And that, by the way, that it refers to the Torah also. He didn't do higher criticism, he did lower criticism. How he reconciled this discrepancy in his views, I do not know. There's all sorts of ways to reconcile it. The positivist historical school does a very good job in reconciling it. You say that it doesn't matter what its origins are. I'm going to read you what Louis Ginsberg has to say about it. But he acknowledges that his views, even though he observes Torah and mitzvot, his views on it are not traditional. So you can see that that's going to be a problem. And we'll see what Israel Hildesheimer has to say. Now, later in the book, he says, it's a funny story. Why is he in Breslau? He's in Breslau because he was sent by, he comes from a Reform family, and they belong to Emmanuel, the Reform temple in Manhattan. And they were like training him or grooming him to take over as the rabbi, but he needed to be trained. So they decided to send him, they gave him a scholarship that he would go to Germany, and it was up to him to find where he went. And he didn't go to the Reform seminary. He went to the, and he speaks about it, he went to the Breslau seminary. He was interested in studying there. And while there, he becomes what he regards as Orthodox. And he never was regarded as non-Orthodox. He tells on page 166 how when he returns, they invite him to preach. He's their up-and-coming person, the one that they sent to Europe to become learned in the Jewish religion, to preach at Emmanuel. And he describes how now he has a problem, because he did want to preach to them, because he thought he should do that. If after all, they gave the money to go to Europe. The problem was the services in Temple Emmanuel, as in all Reformed temples of its type, are conducted with uncovered head. And he says that how can you do Divrei Torah with an uncovered head? How was I to avoid violation of this precept? And he says he couldn't lead the services. That's absolutely impossible. And even delivering a sermon, he says what to do. So he came up with a solution. He did it with an uncovered head. He says he would substitute the Hebrew term Hashem. So whenever he's quoting a pasuk, he wouldn't quote God's name, which is what we do today anyway. He describes how at the end, by the end of the service, the fact that he didn't participate, because how can you participate in a Reform service? It's usher. And they saw from his sermon that he no longer was one of them. And the president or the leader, Mr. Rosenfeld, informed me that my principles precluded the possibility of my becoming the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel. That was the beginning and the end of my connection with the temple. So, it's fascinating that Drachman comes back an Orthodox Jew from Breslau. When I say an Orthodox Jew, I mean an Orthodox Jew not just in practice, but in belief also. He's the one who translated Hirsch's writing, the 19 letters, had a very big influence, and is one of the founders, or one of the leaders, I should say, of the OU. And he always thought of, at least his experience was that it was an Orthodox institution, and the presence of Gretz. I can only imagine it like students at YU, if they have a philosophy professor who says something heretical, which is certainly allowed at YU. The philosophy department is, there's no religious restrictions on it. They'll just chalk it up to, okay, that's his view. That's how he's regarding Gretz, that yes, this is a rabbinical seminary, but not all the professors are in line with what they should be. That's the only way I can explain it. I think it's very similar to the issue of Kaplan, because on page 374, he deals with the problem with the seminary that it couldn't be considered Orthodox anymore because you had Kaplan teaching there. And he quotes, he says that Kaplan's views poison the minds of the teachers of the coming generation, because they had him teaching in the Teachers Institute. So then what to do about it? Well, they asked Cyrus Adler, and who was president of seminary, and Cyrus Adler said to dismiss Dr. Kaplan would be persecution, and the seminary cannot persecute. And then he goes on to explain how it's not persecution at all. If the seminary is an Orthodox Jewish institution, as it's supposed to be, he says, of course you can't keep someone like Kaplan. So it's really fascinating that Drachman does not have a problem with Breslau. Okay, The last, before I wrap it up, I guess it'll probably be next class, we spoke about Hirsch's criticisms. I now want to share with you Israel Hildesheimer, because in the first issue of the Rabbinic Journal Hamayon, which goes back to the 1950s, an article was published by Israel Hildesheimer of Berlin's grandson. His name was also Israel Hildesheimer. He taught Gaonic literature at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, and in 1938 or 39, he makes his way to, he's able to leave, and he goes to Eretz Yisrael, and he becomes librarian of the Rambam Library at Tel Aviv. He lived in Petah Tikva. I met him once when I interviewed him about moving the seminary to Berlin, because he went with his father, Meir Hildesheimer, in 1934 to find a place to move the seminary. And his son is Professor Meir Hildesheimer, who's a well-known scholar. So very important family. So this article is Rav Israel Hildesheimer on Rav Zacharia Frankel. It's Rav Israel Hildesheimer Zatzal, Al Rav Zacharia Frankel Zal, Ubeit Hamidrash Rabbanim Breslau. So we see in the title already something interesting. Hamayan, for those who don't know, is the Journal of German Orthodoxy. It was established in the 50s, and then it stopped publishing for a little while. But since the 60s, it's been publishing four times a year, supported by Mossad Yitzhak Breuer. That's really where you get the German-style Orthodoxy in Israel. Great Torah articles, academic articles. But look at the title. The fact that they publish an article like this is of interest. But the title, Rav Israel Hildesheimer, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Al Rav Zacharia Frankel, Zichrono Livracha, Uveit Midrash Rabbanim Breslau. So they're giving Frankel the title. They don't call him Harav. It's Harav Israel Hildesheimer, and it's Reish apostrophe, so Reb Zacharia Frankel, giving a little respect. But they call him Zalm, Zichrono Livracha. For Hirsch, it's Shin Reish Yud, Shin Rasharim Yerkov. So the Hildesheimer school is more moderate, but not as moderate as you might think when it comes to Frankel. So he has a series of letters, which I find really interesting. And I wanted to share with you what Hildesheimer has to say. The first thing I have to mention, though, is correct a mistake, which I fell victim to. It's my own fault. David Ellenson, in his book on Israel Hildesheimer, claims that Hildesheimer referred to Zachariah Frankel as a mishumad. Now, granted, this is taking me back a long time before I was sophisticated as I am now, but I remember I looked at the source, and I just took Ellenson's word that this is referring to Zacharia Frankel. And now when I think about it, the whole thing doesn't make any sense. What do you mean, Shulman? But I, in one of my essays, I repeated this, that what Ellenson had said, and thanks to, I would have figured it out by now. There's no doubt about that. But I was a young graduate student then, and Schneer Lyman at the time told me that Ellenson was wrong. It was a mistake. And then he publishes a piece in Tradition. You can find it, just Google it. Did Zriel Hildesheimer refer to Frankel as a Mashumad? And he set the record straight. Subsequent to my citing Ellenson in error, I myself found in this this article here that Hildesheimer refers to Frankel as Zichrono Livracha, which is why the title they referred to him this way. So he never referred to him as a Mishumad. It's another Frankel. And if you read the passage that was inside, and they're talking about it, as I recall, a translation of into German of a biblical passage, something like that. But it's obviously, it's not referring to Zachariah Frankel at all. It's referring to a Mishumad, like a real Mishumad. We don't refer to heretics as Mishumad. Do you call them heretics? Maybe even min, but you're not going to call them a mishumad. That's reserved for people who actually convert. Okay, so what are these letters? Well, there's a collection of, I think, four letters here that the grandson put together, where Hildesheimer deals with Frankel. And you'll see more moderation than with Hirsch, but not so much more. So the first two letters are to an Orthodox rabbi, unquestioned Orthodox rabbi. His name was Zev Wolf Feilichenfeld, I think that's how you pronounce it. Someone who Hildesheimer knew for a long time, and writing to him in 1861, He says to him that, you know, well, first of all, how great it is that, you know, we can connect again. I received your letter. He says, you are the only one from my time learning in the university that I correspond with still. Hildesheimer received a PhD from the University of Halle in East Germany. I have a copy of his doctoral dissertation. I located it and discovered it, I guess maybe you can say, located and got a copy of it during the communist times. And I have it. It's written in Latin. And I published from the beginning of it, has, or the end of it, has a Hebrew, in biblical Hebrew, a curriculum vitae, giving his entire life story, which I published in Alei Sefer. But everyone quoted this as if it was appeared in German. It's a Latin dissertation on the Septuagint. I gave it to the Hildesheimer family. They were going to translate it. It's not easy to translate. First of all, it's in Latin, but it deals with Septuagint. So you need to know Latin and Greek. And it's an interesting piece of work. And I have a printout for, and I have the microfilm of it. But then he says that after saying how nice it is to hear from him, he goes, this is translated from German. How is it that you are now part of the Breslau Chevra? And he says that there is very little difference between someone like Geiger that is and what they want to do in Breslau. He said the way he describes it is just a matter of degree. But really, they're looking for the same thing. So how could you be involved with Breslau? So, 1861, no, that's Hildesheimer is before his time, really. He's seeing the problems. That's Darchei HaMishnah is published then, I think. I forget, I think that was the year it was. But that's early on. Now you have a lot of people didn't really see the issues here. In fact, let me... this is an important point here. Hold on, let me see something here. Because the fact that Hildesheimer is so negative against Frankl at this early years. Let me see for a second here. Yeah, Darchei HaMishnah is 1859. Okay, so it's. It's not that it's around that time. So, you could say that, but the controversy had already broken out. Okay. That's the first letter. Then he has a second letter again to, the Rav of Feilachenfeld. That's how you pronounce it. I've seen the name in German a lot. I forget exactly, if there's an E between the L and the C. But he's the rabbi in Dusseldorf. So he's serving as the Orthodox rabbi there. And again, he writes to him and he says that already in my youth, because obviously Feilachenfeld had wrote back, why are you so upset, with Frankl? What did he do that's so terrible? And Feilachenfeld must have mentioned the articles in Yeshurun, which he thought were over the top. And Hildesheimer writes back that I too was upset when I read the article in Yeshurun, but nevertheless, he says, I thought that it was necessary to do this. And then he explains why. He says, even in my youth, I began to have doubts about Frankl. That is before Darchei HaMishnah, when Frankl was regarded as an Orthodox rabbi by everyone else. Hildesheimer says, I began to have doubts about him. Because of two things he did. One of them, he says that there's no ein lo kapara. What is it? It's what I mentioned. When the Chasam Sofer apostled this Rabbi Alexanderson, Frankl said the Chasam Sofer is not right. He has to give him another chance. So Hildesheimer says, how can he go against the Chasam Sofer? Rabban shel kol b'nei hagola. And then later on, Frankl opposed Chacham Bernays when Chacham Bernays attacked the Hamburg reformers. Frankl also opposed the Hamburg reformers, but he thought that certain things Bernays said were incorrect. That is, you can never make any adjustments to the sitter. And Hildesheimer says that he attacked Bernays in a degrading fashion. So Hildesheimer said that I had problems with him from a long time. And then he says something else entirely. He says that I know with certainty that Frankel is not concerned with the religious thinking, the religious belief of the student at the seminary. Simple as that. He says, take my word for it, Falkenfeld, that I'm not saying anything here that I can't prove. He says, I have his book, Darkhei Mishnah, etc. But the important thing is, he says, and he's going to repeat this later, that students are going to the Breslau Seminary and they're coming out heretics. Because Frankel, his concern is not with raising up pious students. He's just doing scholarship. And he says, I regard this as a zechut for me, a merit, that for a number of years now, I preventing students who graduate musmachim from Breslau from getting positions, rabbinic positions. And he says, we're going to see this. He says, I prevent students from going to Breslau. He says that it's a great schus to me that people ask me and I tell them don't go to Breslau. And by doing that, that don't go to Breslau, I make sure they don't become hypocrites or even worse, namely heretics. He says the whole idea of Judaism there is not taken seriously the way we do. And what's the proof of it? That Gretz is given a class to teach in Talmud. How can Gretz teach Talmud? He says, what type of mockery does this make for Judaism that we've never seen such a mockery before, that an institution that claims to be a Torah institution is giving a heretic like Gretz to teach Talmud, like it's just an academic class, and the students are not going to be negatively influenced. And then he says, this is teaching the students in Breslau to become savuim, hypocrites, Jesuitical. That is, say one thing in your mouth, believe another thing. Kofrim. And who are they like, these students? Bedoma Legretz. They're going to turn out just like Gretz. Asher besukot on Sukkos. Gretz on Sukkos, he says, you can see him shaking the lulav just like he's a Hasidic Sherebi. Kafik Shani Yodemi Makar Naaman, as I know from, I've been told reliably. And yet this same guy who's shaking the lulav and doing all the other mitzvos, like a Hasidic Sherebi with all the kavanas and everything, during the week he's teaching heresies. So, that's the problem with Breslau for Hildesheimer, that it's a whole shotness, kilayim. You could have Torah being taught in a proper fashion in one classroom, and the very next classroom the students go to, they're being taught heresy, and which was exactly the case at, let's say, the Jewish Theological Seminary. You could have one thing, you could be with Shaul Lieberman in one class, and then you can move over to Kaplan in another class. And so that's his letter to Falkenfeld. Then he has two more letters, which are really, they're touching and they're sad, all combined, because there's a, they deal with a musmach of Breslau, who by all measures, and Hildesheimer also seems to acknowledge this, is a Yorei V'Shalem, a traditional Jew in all ways. And he's very upset that Hildesheimer has been saying that you can't rely on musmachim of Breslau, and is advising synagogues not to hire them. And he writes to Hildesheimer saying, what do you have against me? I'm a Shomer Torah mitzvos. I observe everything. I believe everything. I don't believe what Gretz says. And yet, why are you telling places that they shouldn't hire us? So it's one thing when Hildesheimer is just saying, to his Orthodox friends, his rabbis, these things. But now he has to respond to someone, and it's more personal here. And you see the sensitivity of Hildesheimer in a way that I wonder if Hirsch would have been so sensitive or Hirsch would have been more dogmatic. But so he writes to him. His name was Theodor Kroner. I don't know what... Well, actually, it says he later becomes rabbi in Stuttgart and was the rabbi of the whole area. But this was earlier than that. He writes to Hildesheimer, and Hildesheimer writes back, and he says to Hildesheimer says as follows: "You should believe me when I say that I esteem everyone who searches and wishes to, be a Shomer Torah Mitzvos in a proper fashion. Not only that, I encourage that. But nevertheless, with all this simcha that I have for anyone who's worthiest, because the guy wrote to him, Kroner wrote to Hildesheimer saying that I'm a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. What do you have against me?" So Hildesheimer writes back and says, "Even I'm very happy to hear this. I admire everyone who's a Shomer Torah Mitzvos. Nevertheless, this doesn't take away from my deep pain that what people have told me, and without any doubt, it's been assured to me that we cannot rely that people who come out of the Breslau Seminary see themselves as tied unconditionally to the words of our sages." And he says, "I'm telling this to you why I wrote this letter." And I'm going to read you the letter in a little bit, what he says about how you can't hire these rabbis. And he says, I don't usually get involved in these matters. He says, "I didn't want to be the one attacking, but, when I'm asked, I have to ask." And then he says, "I don't ask people the same way I say that I don't tell others to accept my opinion, and I don't get involved in rabbinic people being appointed to rabbinic positions. But when I'm asked, I have to honestly give my opinion. And I have to say that," and he goes on, "the fears I have of this institutions." He says that this is what, in my mind, a rabbi today needs to have. And what the apostles, a rabbi. And he says one of the first things that apostles the rabbi in his mind is, he says that there is a heter, and he puts this in quotes, "given that Rebbetzins can go pruat rosh with uncovered head." And he says that in the Breslau Seminary, he says, certainly the majority of the wives of the rabbis are not wearing a shadel. Now, this is funny because in Lithuania, Lithuanian yeshivas, 100 years later, that would be the same case. But this, Germany was different. They were mocked on this in Berlin and Frankfurt. And he says, "I don't know your situation, whether your wife does or not," but he says, "but I know that in Breslau, this is not taken seriously by most. And therefore, how can I recommend a rabbi who comes from there?" Then he says, he gives other examples, and he says that "my conscience does not permit me to say in a positive fashion that this judgment that I made, that Breslau rabbis are not reliable, does not fall on you as well." He says, "Sarli ma'od. I am very sorry. It's very difficult, but I have to say this. But you asked for me an honest opinion." So in other words, Hildesheimer is saying to Kroner, "Although I can admire you, you tell me that you're committed to Torah, and I feel, a sense of admiration for you. Nevertheless, knowing the Breslau Rabbinical Seminary, and I only know you through this letter, I can't honestly say that what I've said does not fall on you as well." And then he says as follows. Kroner had asked, "What do we need to do that you will accept us as compatriots?" And he says, first of all, he says he doesn't know if this can really take place, but he says, first of all, Breslau graduates must declare in a formal fashion publicly that they believe b'kadmut halacha Moshe Mitzrayim, that they believe in halacha Moshe Mitzrayim. So you see, the issue, unlike Drachman, the issue is the theological issue for Hildesheimer as much as it is for Hirsch. And they have to believe in the Kedusha of the Torah Shebichtav and Baal Peh. Lo rak halacha maaseh. Not just that they're observant. That we know they're observant. but they have to recognize the origin of it, and that their historical investigations cannot subvert these basic principles of faith. And he says, and this is my opinion, which I say to you, and I say to you as a man and as a Jew, and he says that, and this is what I don't know if Hirsch would have said, but maybe he would have. He says, nevertheless, I tell you that this dispute between us does not, at least from my side, change the relationship that we have, you know, this relationship of respect that we have through correspondence. So Hildesheimer says, he's saying that, you know, I have respect for you. I understand that you're doing to the best of your conscience what you think is best. But from my standpoint, it's not enough because we diverge on certain basic, or we might diverge on certain basic theological points. So as I said, it's a touching letter because he's showing that he respects him. And he says even his admiration that he's trying for what he has to be an observant Jew, but he doesn't think he could be a rabbi. You know, that's not enough that Hildesheimer can then say, you can be a rabbi. And even if he could, what about the other Breslau ones? So Hildesheimer, I guess, line in the sand that Breslau simply doesn't work. Now, of course, I'm surprised that Hildesheimer didn't say there is a solution. You come to me. You learn for a year at my institution, and then we'll give you a new smicha. And then we've had cases like this. There have been people who've gone to the seminary and then JTS and then got an Orthodox smicha and be completely accepted in the Orthodox world. I don't know why Hildesheimer doesn't. Well, maybe because the person doesn't ask that, but he doesn't say that. Then he has another letter. And well, I already see it's 9:29. So, and this also, this letter is also interesting because Krona replied to him, and he replies back to Krona. So, I want to keep this letter till next week because this is where he also speaks about Frankel, and that's where you have a difference between him and Rav Shamshon Rathel Hirsch. So, I'll leave that to next class. And next class, I also want to talk a little bit about how the next generation, the generation after that, in New York, Louis Ginsberg Jewish Theological Seminary, how they took these ideas of the Breslau Seminary and went really much further than that. And I'll try to sum up next class, really, what we can say about the significance and the uniqueness of the ideology of positive historical school. And if we don't get to a next class, we'll do one more class. I just have a few more tidbits, side points, things people asked about Frankel. Show you another Haskama of Frankel that was in a Sefer and some other interesting things. But and talk a little bit about Catholic Israel of Solomon Schechter. So we'll do that next class. In the meantime, let me get to the questions here. Jacob Sasson says, it's not the Kamatz which makes a Shvana, it's the Mamid. There's different opinions on this because the word kedma, you have, if you go to the Kisei Rachamim website, there they explain it that, it's not because the mamid, they explain it there. It's because the trup is on the, first syllable, is on the syllable that has before the shva. That's where they have it. I know that others put the stress on the metag there, but I'm just saying if you go to the Kisei Rachamim website and if you look at, I think it's also maybe in the Hatikun HaMeduyak, it might be there, but it's on the Kisei Rachamim website. I can send it to you more than once. One person, by the way, on the website, because they discussed this question numerous times, does say what you say, but their expert on Dikduk gives another explanation. And Rabbi Mazuz himself says that the issue is the where the trup is on, that you take a word like, as I said, kedma, and there's many others you can get, that it's on, it's mila el, right before the shva. So Rav Mazuz says that is the reason to explain it. Assume you've mistyped, those are general rules where it is na, unless it's exclusionary. However, there's this one exception to rule Aleph. Not every first letter of Shva is Aleph. Oh, yes. Well, because you can't take a letter like Aleph, can't take the Shva. But So it'll take a shva, it'll take a, has to take a chataf with it. But I was just, what I was said from last class is that I was a little flustered, and what I was trying to, and I couldn't remember, was cases where after a tnuah gedola, it's a shva nach. And I couldn't remember this rule, which I guess, thank you, Jacob. There's actually different opinions as to what explains the rule, but there are cases where it's after tnuah gedola, it's a shva nach, either because of the mamid or because of the trup is on is not on the milah ra, it's milah el. Mel says, you said moving the seminary to Berlin. Oh, you're right. I meant moving the seminary to Israel. I'm referring to when the Nazis came to power and Israel Hildesheimer's son, Meir Hildesheimer, decided that the best thing is to move the seminary to Eretz Yisrael. He went with his son, the young Israel Hildesheimer, to Eretz Yisrael to figure out if they could do that. They met with Rav Kook, who I heard this from Israel Hildesheimer. Rav Kook gave permission in his mind. He said that you could move it, but not to Jerusalem, move it to Tel Aviv. But Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski organized the rabbis and put a lot of pressure on them, saying, do not bring it to the land of Israel. And in Rav Chaim Ozer's letter, and he wrote more than one letter, he says that when Israel Hildesheimer established the rabbinical seminary, it was a very important thing and it did great work. However, only in Germany. But in Eretz Yisrael, where you have yeshivas of the old school, why are you going to bring a rabbi factory? That's what he called it, a Beit Charoshet Rabbanim. Why are you bringing that to the land of Israel? And Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg was very offended by it. He writes, we have his letter to Rav Chaim Ozer, which I published it in my doctoral dissertation, as I recall, and also in Kisser B'chirik of Weinberg. He says, "You call us a rabbi factory? We teach Torah at the highest level." And Rabbi B'chirik of Weinberg opposed moving the seminary for a different reason. But thank you, Mel. Rabbi Shudnow says, "In a symposium in Jerusalem, I publicly asked my great teacher Lieberman how JTS could have non-religious teachers. He answered that they do not teach Torah, rather technical subjects like language, grammar, history." Well, it's not really a correct answer because they gave Kaplan Midrash and homiletics, but Kaplan also taught, you could say, in the teacher seminary. So maybe Lieberman would say, well, it's not the rabbinical school. As far as I know, Kaplan did not teach these subjects in the rabbinical school, but the students took these courses with Kaplan. Am I correct, Rabbi Shundow? They took these student courses with Kaplan in the Teachers Institute, so it really didn't matter. As Rabbi Kamens, who you might know, said, whatever they assigned Kaplan to teach, he was teaching Kaplan. Eric says, aren't there some academics who teach a documentary hypothesis but are accepted as remaining Orthodox? Well, I wrote an article about this on, and not only did I write an article in Modern Judaism, I wrote an article, sort of review essay that appeared in Lehrer House just this week. Was it this week? No, Thursday. If you go to Lehrer House, you can, my first piece ever in Lehrer House, they asked me to review this book. Yes, there are academics who teach the documentary hypothesis and they're maybe Orthodox in quotes or orthoprax. I don't know. In some places they are accepted as then in other places they're not accepted. I mean, that depends what shul you go to. But certainly for Hildesheimer and Hirsch, this would not be acceptable. And it's not so much orthodox as orthoprax. Today, I understand they're used. We collapse the differences. And if you see someone who's a Shomer Torah mitzvos, people refer to him as orthodox. But what the point that Hirsch was making and Hildesheimer was making is that that's not the issue here. That never was the issue. The issue is dogma. The issue is doctrine. The issue are basic fundamentals of faith. You could observe Torah all you want, but if you deny basic fundamentals of faith, that puts you out of the fold. And that's the issue. So I don't think that an academic who teaches documentary hypothesis would be orthodox, because the word orthodox means straight faith, straight thinking. I think it would be orthoprax, unless we're going to expand the definition of orthodox, which is that was this new book came out. So that's something that people can talk about if they want. So this is not the same Feilchenfeld, thank you, Adassa, Rav in Poznan from 1870 to 1913. This would be his son, not because this is, it would have to be his son because I'll tell you who, no, but this is Zev Wolf Feilchenfeld, but it can't be the same one because he was born in 1827. So, no, I guess it would be. That's the one because of 1827 has to be. The thing is though that what then does Hildesheimer mean when he says he's writing in 1861? If 1827, 1847, yeah, so that would be in 1861 he would be 1857. Oh, 30 some years old. So he, yeah, that's the same one. Absolutely. It has to be the same one. So he lived a long life. Thank you. And thank you, Jay, for pointing it out. Yes, it's the same. Okay. So he's without question an Orthodox rabbi. I don't think that by, the latter part of his life, he was, associated in any way with the Breslau school, but we see here that at least for a time, whatever this means, that he fell in with them, that he thought that they were acceptable, and that's what Hildesheimer is writing to him about. That why do you regard them as acceptable? They're not acceptable. Yeah, I should have. There's a little bit of an introduction here to the letters, yeah. So you're absolutely right. Thank you very much for pointing it out. He mentions one more thing I'll mention. He mentions in his letter one of the problems, an example of the problems of the Breslau approach is Rabbi Gudeman, Rabbi Moshe Gudeman, who was the rabbi of Vienna. Here he was, the rabbi of Vienna, and yet he was a student of Frankl. He wasn't a Moritz Gudeman. He got his smicha. He was a musmach of the seminary in Breslau. And he wasn't exactly Orthodox, although if you go to Vienna today and you go to the synagogue, the main synagogue in Vienna, they have the list of all the rabbis, and Gudeman is there. But by no stretch of the imagination were his ideas, quote, Orthodox. He was a member of the historical school, and he accepted certain radical ideas about Tanakh. And yet today in the institutional memory of the Stadt Temple in Vienna, you go there on tours and you see they make it seem as if these are all Orthodox rabbis. They're not. The synagogue always functions as an Orthodox synagogue. Men and women never sat together. There was never an organ. But they hired Breslau rabbis until also Tzvi Peretz Chayes, I think, would be regarded in that camp as well, the grandson of the Maharetz Chayes, who also served as rabbi there. Okay, I think that's... 1872 is when he's rabbi. 1827, it says here, is when he was born. In fact, I even have the date, the 15th of Sivan, born in Poznan as well. Very good. Okay, I think that's it then, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. Okay, very good. Okay, please go. See you next week. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman continues his series on Sefer Daniel at 1 p.m. Eastern. And as I mentioned earlier, on Wednesday, Dr. Lindsay Guhartz will be starting her series on Judaism and Christianity at 11 a.m. on Wednesday morning. Rabbi Helfgott, Wednesday evening. Thursday, Rabbi Yellen will be finishing a series on business ethics. If you haven't had a chance to come to the past two, this is a three-part series. So that'll be Thursday at 1 p.m. And then Thursday night, 8:30 p.m., Dr. Rebecca Winter will be giving the Parsha Shir from Atlanta. And, of course, I'll be giving my regular Shir on the Siddur, 9:30 a.m. on Friday morning. Okay, we look forward to learning with you. And please invite a friend, and we look forward to seeing you soon, everybody. Have a good night. Laila to everybody. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.